Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 100 of Dom and Ari's Judgment, a weekly Constructive Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And to celebrate this momentous occasion, we are bringing you a truly normal episode featuring an unremarkable range of topics with not even a guest, not even a special guest of any kind. It's just the two people you hear week in, week out on these airwaves.
Yeah, you'd think they would stop doing important things so that we could have a week to just talk about bullshit, but things happened this week, and we should talk about them.
Yeah, there was some stuff, some things, some discourse. Not a lot of nonsense, sadly. People were being very well-behaved this week, which, given this time on our calendar, you'd think they would heap some on us for this special occasion, but I guess we have been forgotten about once again. But regardless of that, we do have a lot to get to. So the big talking point from this week is, of course, the standard bans that were announced on Monday, and those bans by themselves are probably like the expected outcome in terms of the bans. I don't think there's anything too shocking there. No real omissions that I think were that people were expecting to go, unless you had the keys jingled in front of you and you bought into that that leaked list on Reddit that had 8 or 9 cards in it or whatever. But for the most part, I think if you ask people to predict what cards are going to go on Monday, these are the 3 cards that were at the top of the list. So we will touch on those. There was some stuff to get to there, but we thought it might be a nice springboard for a larger discussion of just the most remarkable in just a positive sense and also in a derogatory sense in terms of bans that we've seen across the entire 30-year sweep of Magic at this point.
Yeah, there are some very fun ones, even if you exclude... I guess we'll talk about that, but like everything before about 2000, when I did the sweep, I just kind of ignored that because I wasn't around for it. And also, yeah, it's some special stuff going on there.
And also just nobody had a clue what was going on the inside, on the outside. It was the Wild West out there. But here in 2023, we have 3 cards being escorted from the building here in Standard. Fable of the Mirrorbreaker, Reckoner Bankbuster, and Invoke Despair. In, I think, order of how locked in those were. So with Fable, everyone knew it was going. The only question really was, why is it still here in the first place? I don't know if there's too much more to add on that one, unless you have any hot takes to usher in at the last moment there.
No, if you didn't ban Fable, you should just have 0 cards on the list.
Yeah, I guess the most compelling contrarian take that I've heard about Fable, and this doesn't even mean you don't ban it, but it's just a warning sign potentially, is there's always going to be a best card in Standard or a few cards that are cut above the rest. And even if that's not true in a theoretical sense, like it certainly seems to be true historically, and Fable is a pretty good card to be the best card, I think, especially if you compare to some of the more notorious offenders from the past few years.
I guess it is a fine card on play pattern, sort of, to be a best card, but at the same time, like, it's possibly the best card in Pioneer. Like, it is so far above the line, it's not even funny.
Yeah, I do wonder if something that really moved this ban from 90-something percent to a mortal lock is the fact that you still are going to have this experience, certainly in Pioneer and also in Modern for the foreseeable future as well. So it's not like if you brought your Fables, you're feeling betrayed that you don't get any more chance to play them. And also, if you're sick of Fable, well, you're going to be sick of it for quite some time. There's going to be no shortage of those in the officially supported competitive formats in the near future. And so that's, I think, a case to get it out of Standard, because like one of the things that was really demoralizing in like the Oko and Uro era, among others, is that not only were these cards clearly just the best cards to the point where you weren't sure how they made their way out the building in the first place, but also they're the best cards everywhere, and there's just nowhere to take refuge from these. And so I do like having some explicit idea that, like, okay, the line for Standard is here, the line for other formats is elsewhere, and it's possible for a card to flit in between those gaps to where it's maybe over the line in Standard and basically unplayable in those other formats.
Oh my gosh, it is so much better to play against Fable in Modern and Pioneer than it, like, and even Legacy. Like, it's just, when it's just a card, like, even if it's ubiquitous across all the formats, if it's just, like, a card there among the other cards, it's so much better than if it's just so far over the line that it's the card. Like, it's just, the Oko experience was truly horrific, and I really, if the line stops at Fable, that is way better. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah, I think you, in Fable's defense, I think you could draw a useful contrast between Fable and Oko, where the Oko experience was none of the text on my cards matters because my cards don't do anything anymore. Every one of them is a 3-3 elk, and my 3-3 elks don't do anything against Oko with how its numbers line up, and also can easily be blanked by anything else. And so when none of your cards do anything, well, you just draw more cards or draw more Okos, or the game collapses into this very silly toy game. With Fable, it feels like Fable is setting up whatever you want to be doing in some way because it does so many things. So the rummaging, where like, that's good for fixing your draw, very good if you're some kind of reanimator deck, for example. Or it's nice to have a thing that leaves behind a bunch of rectangles, but if, you know, if you're a creativity deck in Pioneer or Modern, having a non-creature rectangle that makes a creature rectangle, that's really good. So you can find ways to zoom in on any one part of Fable, and even if you're not using any one aspect in particular, Fable is just a really nice card that sets up everything else. So in our Pioneer discussion last week, we mentioned that the five color Brinklight deck, one of the worst Fable decks of all time in terms of it's pretty bad at using any specific part of that card, and yet the sum total of that package is good enough that it just finds its way in there regardless. And so it often feels like Fable is not the thing that you're losing to. It sets up the thing that you're losing to, but maybe that disguises just how oppressive the card is in practice, because like you can clearly trace the history of the game and realize, yeah, if they didn't have the turn 3 Fable, the entire thing looks pretty different.
Yeah, I think the only time it feels very obvious that you lost a Fable is when you literally can't answer the Goblin token, which happens, or when they have built their deck in such a way that the Kiki Jiki ability is like burying you in Blood Tithe Harvesters.
In the short term, then, it's hard to see how Standard is going to shake out, and I'm keen to look over the list from the first few weekends of Standard challenges and so on to see exactly what comes out of that. But it seems like the format might kind of shrink a little, if anything, because of the Fable decks, the most successful one is Rakdos, like the mid-range versions. But those decks also, I think, are more able to adapt to the loss of Fable. Like, there are a lot of Fable adjacent cards that can kind of do a decent impression sometimes, whereas like in the reanimator decks, for example, there's no replacing Fable. Like, Fable just is so unique in terms of what it offers there. And I think that goes for a lot of the more adventurous decks that use Fable as a bridge to what they want to be doing. And so a lot of those are really going to struggle to survive, whereas the Rakdos deck is hobbled but probably going to be around still.
Yeah, my current opinion is that, I guess you described these as like the three most likely to be banned cards. I actually had a different card in third place, and I'm interested to see what happens to the format in light of wedding announcements still being legal. That card is very comparable to Fable in the scope that it impacts a game almost. But the thing I think about that card that is different is that there is a very set sort of, like, when you approach Fable as a card, it is very hard to obsolete the pieces that it puts together. Whereas a card like Wedding Announcement gives you a lot of material, but if you just have big stuff, like, just big is often good enough against tokens like that. I'm interested to see how that plays out and whether we are actually allowed to play things that are just big in the format.
Yeah, I think that comparison does highlight part of what made Fable so good, which is that you could try to contest any part of what the card was doing, but you had to know for sure that the opponent cared about that thing as opposed to any one of these five other things. And then even if you won that little battle that you chose to pick, well, you still probably spent a card doing that, and they're still getting all of this other stuff from their Fable, so that's a Pyrrhic victory, if it's a victory at all. So, yeah, often you would play your Fable, you would get your Goblin token, and just send the Goblin on a suicide mission in your next combat, just because that treasure would bridge you to your 5-drop a turn earlier, and that would define the game, unless they dealt with it. And if they dealt with it, well, now you're working your way towards Chapter 2, Chapter 3, your Reflection's more likely to live, and then the second chapter maybe drew you a backup 5-drop that you now get to curve into on turn 5. So just, it's like you had to fight over Fable, but fighting over the Fable just felt like a losing battle most of the time. Whereas a card like Wedding Announcement, it theoretically can do a few different things, but mostly it does one focus thing. And if you don't care about that, or you can go toe-to-toe with that, then it feels like you're just fighting a normal fight, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, the resources are all on the axis of, like, here is some stuff on the battlefield, whereas Fable is a lot more, like, moving cardboard, producing mana, like, all that stuff. And I think Announcement may bridge into the actual discussion of Invoke, which I think I 100% agree with their description of it. I think that from a top-level, discussion in the format, I don't really see the difference between Invoke and, like, most of the other cards that cost more than three. But I do get that there is a sort of Rampaging Ferocidon aspect to this, where this is a very specific, like, I mean, it's just the issue that you saw time and time again, where it's like, okay, so the thing I want to do against this attrition deck is bring in an enchantment that provides value. And then they just cast Invoke, and you're just like, well, cool. Like, same with Planeswalkers. Like, there is this idea of, like, the bridging of, like, answering problematic permanent types with card advantage is a very big deal. And, like, actually, if you look at a lot of historical spots where midrange has dominated, a good piece of it has been a result of, like, some removal spell that oversteps the line on coverage and makes it very hard for people to contest. Like, it makes everyone who tries to do something cool and interesting that sidesteps the midrange battle dragged back and fight the midrange battle. And, like, Invoke, like, does that hands down. Like, it will kill your opponent if they try to ignore the board. It will kill their enchantments and planeswalkers if they try to, like, single-shot card advantage you. Even if, like, in practice, it's kind of about the same as the other five drops, I think that just, like, knowing you are not, like, oh, why should I do this because I'm just going to get invoked, like, that not being part of the equation is a pretty big deal.
Yeah, if the argument against Fable and also Bankbuster is they're just too flexible and too good in any deck that can cast them, which for Bankbuster is literally any deck, then Invoke Despair is the exact opposite. It's a five drop with incredibly demanding mana requirements, and so just on that basis alone, with that description, you'd expect to get a lot in return. And it's not clear to me that Invoke is over the line in that regard. Like, yeah, it even just compared to the rest of the Invoke cycle, right? Like, Invoke Despair feels, I don't think they missed the mark in, like, development terms, right? But in the context of what Standard has been like since the last rotation, where black midrange of some form has been pretty dominant, and Invoke Despair just patches up all these holes and addresses these cards which normally would be problematic for those starter midrange decks, then yeah, contextually, I think it was definitely going to be on the watch list. There is this weird subtext to the announcement, though, because they mentioned that certain card types tend to be good against these grindy decks. So enchantments and planeswalkers were called out. Those are the two that Invoke Despair is good against. But there's also a color pie issue too, where specifically Rakdos, just it was decided 30 years ago that this color combination was not going to be able to deal with enchantments, and that has, in a time of so much flux elsewhere, this is like the one thing that you have been able to take to the bank every single time. And in recent years, we've had one or two cards in those colors that gesture towards killing enchantments, but that's only been in these sets where, right, we have an enchantment block coming up, so we better give black something at least. It's by necessity rather than design. It's not good, I think, if you play a winning announcement now against Rakdos and it is literally indestructible. There's just no way for them to remove it. But it's also not good on the other extreme, where enchantments like that are kind of soft banned from the format because they just line up too badly against Invoke Despair. And I think it's pretty difficult to strike a happy balance there. And so, to me, when we said that Fable and Bankbuster, they don't really stop you from playing what you want to be playing. They set it up, if anything. Invoke Despair does kind of stop that. And in that regard, it does remind me of other cards that have been banned, or at least have kind of throttled diversity in formats in the past. So, like, Reflector Mage, for example, Teferi Time Raveler, these cards which, in their formats, you just couldn't put a card in your deck that lined up poorly against those cards. That was a deck-building violation. And if you commit three of those, then you're not allowed to build any decks anymore. I remember when Woodland Wanderer came out, right, in Battle for Zendikar. It's like, okay, this is like a really cool card you can imagine putting in your mid-range decks with all of these flexible mana bases. And the moment that Reflector Mage came out in the next set, that card was just banned. It wasn't on the ban list, but it was banned because the idea of doing that in a Reflector Mage format was just so stupid that you couldn't consider it. And there's stuff which hasn't been banned, but which has had a similar effect, so like Dromoka's Command. It's so difficult to register enchantments in a format where just the default best decks have Dromoka's Command and can just kill that for free at a profit. And so I think cards like that maybe should be the target for bans more liberally than the stuff like Fable or Bankbuster, which, yeah, they're kind of best at what they do, but they kind of coexist more harmoniously with whatever stuff you want to be doing as well.
Yeah, I think that there's kind of a split here where, like, there's also this problem of, like, Oblivion Ring wasn't in standard and Jace was legal. Jace the Mind Sculptor was legal. Like, that was a huge problem at the time. So I think that there are, like, it is, I wish I had a good heuristic on where to draw the line, but, like, the more free it is, like you said, the soft ban, because it's an effect you would play anyways. I think that that is the kind of stuff that should raise a flag, even if, like, you don't end up doing anything about it. Like, that's just, like, the, this is something that, like, deserves a discussion.
With enchantments, you could theoretically layer some of them so that the one that you did care about was protected from at least a first Invoke Despair. So with the white mid-range decks against Rakdos, it was pretty common that you would play out an ossification on something that you didn't care about, or sometimes just without even a target at all, so that when you did play your Wedding Announcement or did play your Restoration of Vygandra or whatever, it wouldn't get called up by the Invoke Despair a few turns down the line. So in that regard, you did have some interesting deadbunning choices and gameplay choices as a response to it, kind of preempting it with that in mind. With Planeswalkers, that's a lot harder to do. It's just pretty hard to control several Planeswalkers at once, and so cards that would otherwise be good in these mid-range fights, like the Eternal Wanderer, or there's that 5-drop Teferi from the Brothers War, which, really flashy card, not really playable in the face of Invoke Despair, especially with Planeswalkers being, like, the marquee cards, like the headliners for a lot of sets, you kind of want those to be at least in the mix and not automatically disqualified unless they have, like, very specific attributes.
Yeah, I will say that the experience of, like, there was a learning experience and learning curve over the format where people realized, like, oh, if I cast the Wandering Emperor and I make a Samurai token and then they play Invoke, that exchange is not the worst, where I just lose, like, not much of a Planeswalker and a token. It's kind of like they paid 5 mana to, like, cantrip kill a creature almost. Like, that's not, like, the end of the world, but yeah, I think that, like, the entire class of Planeswalkers that didn't make a token on the spot being banned, not great.
Yeah, I think that also pushes the Planeswalkers that are good in the direction of this quite boring Planeswalker template of, well, I play my Planeswalker and it just churns out rectangles every turn until it just buries you in rectangles. And I kind of like the Planeswalkers that at least attempt to do other things, and those are the ones that get punished the hardest by a card like Invoke Despair.
Yeah, I do want to talk about, like, in this discussion of Invoke, there was another card that people talked about, which is Atraxa, as a 7-drop that should be banned. I don't even care. All the 7s are just so the same in this format. Like, you can cast an Atraxa, you can cast an Atali, you can cast a Behold. Like, we're talking about, like, this positive, like, this detrimental feedback effect with Invoke. Atraxa, honestly, in the context of these other 7s, has the reverse, where, like, if 7s are good, you kind of want to play an Atraxa deck, but if you're the one playing Atraxa and everyone else is playing Atali and Behold, like, that's bad. Don't do that.
Yeah, I am excited to see the top end of the format now, if it is just these Atali versus Atraxa versus Breach and Multiverse battles, and then how does stuff like Invasion of Alara fit in there? And there's a lot of big stuff you can do if you want to dream big in this format. Like, Alian Trazi is going to have a fun time streaming Standard over the next few months. But I think there is also room now to go underneath all of that stuff. So things like the Mono Blue deck, Blue White Soldiers, a lot of the decks which were kind of edged out by Rakdos before, and all of the anti-aggro stuff from Rakdos is still around, but those decks are now more thinly stretched between, well, I have to deal with the creature decks over here, and I also have to deal with the Atali, Atraxa, God knows what else decks up here, and it's hard for a mid-range deck to do that. Rakdos got to square that circle until now by just having this recipe that was pretty sound against everything, and two of the core pieces of that have just disappeared.
Yeah, and I guess we kind of have lightly glossed over Bankbuster in this context. I think you said that the card is, like, sort of fine on design principles, but just, like, too ubiquitous, and yeah, that's about it. Call those cards are dangerous.
If you could somehow guarantee you wouldn't see it as often, I think the play experience with it is A-okay. But just in practice, when basically any deck can cast it, you have, like, some of these aggro decks boarding into it, even just for those longer games, kind of like the treasure map in the red deck sideboards back in the day. But then also you have the five color domain deck just going turn two Bank Buster, turn three Topiary Stomper, attack you for four, and that they're just like this weird aggro deck now out of nowhere. Like, it's just too good at what it does, and it does basically everything. So yeah, you're gonna see it a lot, and I think we have just kind of got sick of that experience collectively by now.
Yeah, or, you know, not sick of, but more just like, this is how you change stuff, and that's fine. And similarly, Meat Hook staying on the ban list is fine. Like, you are banning a bunch of cards out of the Rakdos midrange deck. Just, like, let it ride for a minute before you see if you want to unban a card from it.
Yeah, I think some of the hope is that these various creature decks will get their moment in the sun again. So, you know, will Toxic come back? Mono Red, we've mentioned Soldiers. There have been, like, these red-green, like, modified decks with all of the Neon Dynasty cards. Maybe those get this 11th hour boost now. It would be a shame if you unban the card, which is, like, by far the best catch-all against all of the aggro decks at the same time as you're trying to introduce those back into the format again.
Yeah, there is some interesting overlap where, like, the thing that Wedding Announcement Existing pushes is just, like, big stuff, and Meat Hook also pushes in the same direction, so, like, you wouldn't necessarily have that kind of reaction. The best card and the unbanned card are pushing in the same direction, but yeah, it's, like, whatever. We don't need it. It doesn't necessarily need to be banned, but we don't need it around.
Yeah, I think that's a good description of it. So, any called shots for Standard in the short term, then, before we see what people actually show up with?
I mean, obviously, the other thing besides Announcement that has, like, been untouched is the Esper Legends deck. It is all creatures. They're all very good creatures. I think we'll, like, remain to see if that becomes the dominant deck in the format. I don't know, on a surface level, it feels like the kind of thing that should be beatable, but in practice, it's certainly a wait-and-see moment.
Yeah, we saw Lithomantic Barrage in particular do a good job at keeping that deck in check at the Pro Tour. That said, the best and most natural home for that card in the sideboard just got taken down quite a few notches, so not sure where the right home for that is going to be now. I guess it could be the Jeskai Splinter Twin deck, using that term very loosely, that showed up at the Arena Championships with, like, Zergo and Ojutai working with Invasion of Gobakan, and then once you flip your battle, then you have Zergo protected for every other turn as well, and that deck was cool. Did not deliver many wins for the people who chose it, who are also some of the best players in the game right now, so maybe that's a sign to stay away from that, but it was cool to see that piece of innovation at least. I think that is the thing that people were surprised by, which is, like, we've had this issue come up in Standard a lot in the past of, all right, we hit the obvious cards that are causing problems, but then there's something just below the surface of that, which now has no competition, gets to be the Apex Predator, and that might be more obnoxious, if anything. So yeah, if, like, at least with the Rakdos Mirrors, there was a lot of back and forth there, a lot of play to them, a lot of agency, if you like. The Esper Mirrors can be kind of a shit show some of the time, and, you know, if the format devolves into 35% Esper and just whoever is on the play in the mirror gets to curve out more effectively, I don't think that's an upgrade compared to the current situation.
Yeah, I actually, you know what, I might start with this Lesnia Enchantments deck. I am excited to play with Kalix. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, Seth Manfield notably showed up with that deck at the Arena Championships, and another player did as well. So definitely on the radar and somewhat established. And weirdly, even though, like, the raison d'etre for that deck was, I beat up on Rakdos because I'm full of enchantments in a way that, like, your one Invoke Despair cannot touch. So even though its most obvious purpose maybe doesn't exist anymore, I think it's just a good shell of a deck, which now gets a chance to flourish again.
Yep. Yeah, just, like, it's got some powerful cards and powerful synergies. There's not a lot to it. It's not very scientific. It's just, like, these cards are good.
Yeah, and then in terms of final or other omissions from the ban list, I know Shieldred is a big one that a lot of people expected to go as well. I've made my defense of Shieldred on here in the past. I stand by that, even though I can imagine myself getting sick of playing against Shieldred yet again 6 months from now. I think that's fine compared to what the alternative is, and I'm glad that it's a card like Shieldred, which you can just point a removal spell at in theory, that is defining the format, as opposed to the stuff like Fable, which you just can't really contest, or the stuff like Invoke, which kind of soft bans two different card types by itself.
Yeah, and Shieldred, like, it is a creature with stats, and they have known about it for almost a year, and, like, I don't know, it's pretty easy to print a card that beats a creature with stats in a set.
Yes. So with that, any other topics regarding this ban announcement before we move into 30 years and the long and storied history of ban announcements?
No, let's go down that list. Let's talk about the list of ban lists.
Okay, so we do want to give the caveat here at the start that, as we mentioned, a lot of the 90s and early 2000s bands, especially in these larger formats, which were pretty young and kind of unmonitored, they were just kind of throwing darts at boards. And so it is very funny to me that Code Ape was once banned and extended as, like, in an era where creatures were just colossally unplayable, you decided to ban, like, one of the creatures that actually is decent on rate and has aged well. But, you know, they were doing their best, okay? And I can't say if I was there in 96, I would have done any better. So trying to apply modern standards to that, I think, is kind of a lost cause. I think there are also a lot of cards which, you know, we talk about cards which were allowed to have their reign of terror for too long. I think there are cards which languish on ban lists for too long and which have, you know, they've done their time and could be freed without incident, you know, Smuggler's Copter and Pioneer, that sort of thing. But I don't know if that kind of impact is quite the thing that we're looking at here.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think that, like, adding a card back into a format is often, I mean, well, there are some mixed reviews on that in this discussion. Yeah, I would, like, if you want to look back at the history and sort of determine when they actually decided, like, oh, a ban list should be managed in, like, a reasonable fashion, you could probably just start with Urza Saga when it forced them to do that. Everything that was banned before Urza Saga is kind of just, like, people debating whether you should be allowed to play with Balance when you can play with Moxes, and it's just, like, I don't know, like, it's EDH levels of discussion about, like, what even is your philosophy. And then the philosophy is very clearly Talarian Academy is over the line. This is unacceptable. And that, I think, is the line where you're just like, yeah, actual bans are, like, supposed to be happening. Maybe you could point to, like, thawing glaciers just before that. But then, like, this was also, you know, I'm looking at the timeline. It's like the thawing glaciers ban, and then 2 months later, the extended format was created and Juggernaut was on the ban list.
we mentioned they banned Code Ape. They banned Serendipa Freak, which also was one of the other playable creatures. They banned Juggernaut, which I'm not even sure if that was a playable creature, but just to be safe, let's get that one out of there as well.
And like I said, pretty much all of that stuff from, like, the Academy era is still before my time. And there's some jokes about, like, some other bands in this, like, early, like, somewhat definitive era where, like, they banned two cards before they banned Necropotence, but, like, those two cards were Dark Ritual and Mana Vault, which probably should also have not been legal in extended, so.
Yeah, I mean, in their defense, Necro kind of had the Fable problem where people just didn't cotton on to how good it was for quite a while, and I think one of the magazines, I don't know if it was Duelist or Inquest or whatever, had it as their worst card in Ice Age, I believe. So you had some people showing up to the Necro PT with 3 copies of Necro in the deck. Like, it was not universally acknowledged how good this card was. So either on the outside or on the inside at that point.
Yeah, I think it's also very telling that people just tried to play decks that weren't Necro and complained about, like, sometimes losing. Like, yeah, it just, it's one of those things where, like, historically, it's like, oh, like, people were very not in on, like, they weren't, like, desperation trying to beat Necro. It's, like, just a deck that is in the metagame, and they're trying to beat it. And it's like, this card's a lot.
Necro also can be quite a difficult card to play with, as a certain notorious Pro Tour Finals proved in a way that still is, you know, phenomenal television to go back and watch 25 years later.
Yes, that's some good stuff.
Yes. So in terms of, like, actual incidents of bans that we want to highlight here, we'll start with the best, which turns out is going to be a shorter section than some of the least well-advised bans in history here. But we do have a few pretty heads-up bans we want to talk about here. So you compiled this section of the list. I'll let you set up the discussion here.
Yeah, so I think that there is, with the idea of a good ban, like, bans in general, like, there is a negative connotation to removing a card from the format, and that usually means that there was a problem. But there's a kind of heads-upness to, like, deciding to resolve a problem in a specific way or at a specific time. And one of those, I think, that's really important, in probably, like, the best, is just starting Pioneer without fetches. And that's probably the most important one that I think they have generally done.
Yeah, I think that was an easy call, but also a very important call, and obviously the right call, where there have been some precursors to Pioneer in terms of, like, slightly larger formats, kind of a four-year extended kind of size, the had fetches in them, so Frontier comes to mind. And if you go back and unearth some old Frontier decks, you can tell just how warping the effect fetches have on any format where you allow them to be a part, especially if you have typed dual lands in their rhythm. So every one of those decks is like three colors minimum, is pretty easy to splash a fourth if you want to, and it's 12 fetch lands and like the one off-color BFZ jewel that lets your Windswept Heath make red or whatever. And it's just, once you allow for those, for that as a terms of engagement, everything else is downstream with that. And bearing in mind that the Pioneer ban announcement, or sorry, the Pioneer format announcement came like 8 months before they officially printed Triomes, like they knew what was coming down the pipeline in that regard. But like, even if you just confine that to the Prairie Stream cycle of lands, like you had to do this for Pioneer to be a sensible format from the outset. And there were some teething pains early on, but fetches were not allowed to be one of them, and that was a very important call.
Yeah, and even like looking at some simple stuff, like Omnath is not banned in Pioneer, and I don't feel like it's ever been close to being banned, despite being so absurdly broken in Standard and like very good in Modern. And a lot of it just has to do with the fact that Landfall is no longer freely subsidized.
Yeah, Fabled Passage is not a great card unless you are doing specific things with it, and those specific things are not that great in the grand scheme of things. So that whole idea is not free, the way that, you know, you're starting out your Modern deck, you have Renin 6 and Omnath and 12 fetches, and then the world is your oyster. You can just do whatever you want.
Yeah, so that one's just like the very clean one. The other one that I had as like the very obvious clean one was just getting Scheherazade out of the game. Like, it didn't happen, but if it ever did happen, you just wouldn't want to involve yourself in, like, just we're done. Like, there's nothing about that card that is an actual Magic card. There's nothing about it that should be involved in a tournament. Like, just, it wasn't doing anything, but it should not have been there.
How do you feel about a Chaos Orb?
I would be okay with a world where it had not been removed, but at the same time, like, it's just a decision you make, and like, the either the game has that in it or doesn't, and I'm fine with it not having it.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you listen to people who play like old school or whatever talk about the format, there's this entire subtopic of how do you win the Chaos Orb metagame, and like the dexterity sub game, if you like, and trying to train yourself for that. And it's just, I kind of get the charm of that in theory, but if you're trying to do that at scale in any kind of competitive setting, I think it falls apart very quickly.
Yeah, there probably actually are legitimate issues where you could not have Chaos Orb legal and then ban lands in front, where like that, like, I don't know, I've never played with a dexterity card, but it feels like telling players they cannot arrange the board how they want on coverage, like that's just a non-starter. Like, you just imagine like doing coverage at an event and there's just like a creature in the top left corner, a creature in the bottom right corner, lands across the middle, like, no, we're just done with that. I don't want to look at that. It's, you know, these Picasso battlefields are non-starters.
I do like the idea, though, that the effectiveness of my card is determined by just how much table space I have at my LGS or whatever.
Yeah, you know, if it's a Grand Prix in, like, Kansas City, you're probably okay. If it's a Grand Prix in, like, Philadelphia, I mean, all your permanents are going to die.
maybe best to just nix that one altogether. Yeah. Returning to the realm of actual Magic cards, then, I don't know if Vintage just counts as an actual Magic format, but there have been some very good bans in Vintage, and also some very bad bans in Vintage as well, or restrictions, we should say.
Yeah, well, I think the good ones are Vintage has been the format where it feels like they have been willing to take maybe not necessarily the format, but like, compared to Legacy, it feels like they have been willing to take bigger swings at larger staples of the format to kind of make it better. And I think that the restriction of Brainstorm when that happened, and then later the restriction of Chalice of the Void, are two things that were very, very good developments for Vintage that I don't think they have quite managed to mirror in other non-rotating formats with. We'll get to an exception on that.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to frame it, because one interpretation of Vintage across the years is everything is just kept in check by the fact that Mistress Workshop and Bazaar of Baghdad just have diplomatic immunity, effectively, where, like, if you were applying the same criteria to them as to basically any other cards. Workshop would have been on there 20 years ago. Bazaar probably would have been there eventually. But if you actually do that, you just eliminate these two pillars of the format, and it does just reduce to various blue decks and then maybe some mopey creature decks on the side. And so everything else operates under that paradigm. And like, would any other format have Losun Golem Restricted? Well, no, but that's because in every other format, it actually costs 4 mana instead of effectively like 1 to 2 mana, right? I think that there was some post-VSL Twitter discussion where people were saying like, oh, we need to ban, or we need to restrict Walking Blisser. And Pakula came out with like, if this is the conversation we're having, can we just hit the card that is responsible for 10 of these cards being on the list and not, you know, throwing every new card up there as a sacrifice? And that's a good argument. There's no like great counterpoint to that, except for this is just what we agreed that we're doing, and so that's the world we live in.
Yeah, I think that these two bans are very like counter to the continuing unrestrictedness of Workshop and Bazaar, but whatever. Like, maybe, I don't know. I don't know exactly how things have settled out in that metagame currently with the power creep of the last couple of years. I'd be willing to believe that Workshop is acceptable and that Bazaar is like an okay thing to have as a pillar of the metagame, but you're going to have to do a lot of heavy lifting on that front.
Yeah, also I think expecting Vintage to conform to the standards of other formats or just rational standards in general is a lost cause, and also maybe just ignores the point of what Vintage is. Like, this is where basically anything goes, and so yeah, Bazaar is obnoxious, Workshop is obnoxious, a lot of the stuff in the blue decks is obnoxious too. Like, this is the experience that you signed up for. You can always go and play like Modern or Pioneer instead.
I think especially with Bazaar, it is nice to have a deck that does not have a lot of the restricted cards in it.
Yeah, it is worth noting as well. So when Brainstorm was restricted in 2008, it was as part of this sweeping revolution in the format, where that announcement took out Brainstorm and Ponder and Merchant Scroll and Gush for, you know, one spot in that card's long story history, and also Flash, because at the time, fully powered Flash was just one of the best decks. And so overnight, you had this smoldering crater where the format used to be, and you just had to rethink all of these assumptions from the ground up. And at the time, that was kind of what the format needed. And yet, if you talk to Vintage boomers who were heavily invested in 2008, well, this was the format where they got to play, you know, 4 Brainstorm and 4 Merchant Scroll for Ancestral and so on. These were part of just like the firmament of the format, and removing those changed what the format was. And I'm sure there were some people who sold their Vintage collection the next day and never came back, but most of them got over it pretty fast, as they tend to do.
Yeah, and maybe that bridges us into a good discussion of, I think the other format that has managed this successfully is Modern. And I'm not going to talk about, like, the Mox Opal and Faithless Looting bans don't count because they were banned along with actual problems. I think the one I want to point to is Simeon Spirit Guide, where there was a problem, but, like, the problem is very isolated to, like, what is Balustrade Spy doing? And you could argue that that was the loophole being exploited, or that, like, Violent Outburst or whatever, but, like, hitting Spirit Guide in that to sort of end this reshaping of the format from, like, what were the mistakes that had crept into Modern from the 2003 to like 2010 era design where things were a little looser, and ending the line of like looting Opal Spirit Guide felt like a successful reshaping of the format, even if people kind of hated a lot of what happened there.
Yeah, I know that we spoke about Spirit Guide in some detail when we did our episode on the Modern ban list, which I would recommend people go back and listen to if they want to hear more about that. But the interesting tension there is, I don't think there was really any point where a Spirit Guide deck was the best deck in Modern, or where, if it was for a brief time, that Spirit Guide was the main culprit in that existing, but it kind of felt like it was only a matter of time. And so in a context where we have just banned a bunch of different cards, and the format has gone through this period of like stagnation and then upheaval at the same time, almost, this was almost taking the radical step of banning something to prevent us from having to do so in the future, where in like 2023 we print something that pushes some combo deck to at the top of the format, and then that's a Spirit Guide deck, which is just completely off the rails. And so it's almost like placing this future bet on stability by taking the step, which kind of looks weird in the moment, but we're bundling it in with banning Field of the Dead, banning all of these other cards at the same time. And so banning 5 instead of 4 looks a lot more respectable, I guess, and just banning one card out of the blue that didn't seem to have it called for just yet.
Yeah, like, it was definitely the time to do it. Because, again, there were multiple problems pointing in that direction. So, yeah, pretty easy to, like, excuse the undercut there. And then...
I do have some sympathy for, like, the Jonathan Zangs of the world who just, like, saw the entire playstyle that they enjoy ban out from underneath them. And when, like, it was far down the list of what was causing problems in Modern at any time in the past, like, 2 or 3 years. But I'd say they've got over it, too. John certainly hasn't. Maybe some of the others have. I don't know.
I mean, what? You can kill them with Looping Endurances and Aetherflux Reservoir. It's fine.
It builds character. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And... the ad nauseum players, like, I don't know. Have you heard any of them say anything, or did they just finally say, yeah, we know? Like, is that more of, like, you know, releasing someone from prison, or, like...
it's saving them from themselves, maybe.
Yes. The last one I had on this really good list is Stoneforge being unbanned in Modern. Like, that very specific unban felt like sort of like a move in the direction that we see with Modern Horizons 2 in terms of what is actually defining Modern, which... feels like a better place for the format in general. Now, there's like this argument about like whether, you know, you've influxed the format too much, blah, blah, blah. Like, that's been gone over a million times. But when you're unbanning a card that already existed, I don't think you have any of those same issues. And like, when you unban Stoneforge, like, the thing I remember is looking at the list of like decks from the league dump right after it was unbanned, and there were like 40 different Stoneforge Mystic decks that didn't overlap.
Yeah, I think it worked out better than almost anyone expected. I certainly was a little skeptical at the time, as I recall, but I was glad to be proven wrong on that. It felt like something of a tactical unban in the sense that we'd just been through the Hogak fakeout, and then Ludin got banned, and they almost had to throw something out there almost as a consolation. Look, okay, here's a new toy to go off and play with, and hopefully this new... post-Hogak, but post also with Modern Horizons Modern, with this new card, like, that's going to invigorate things and we get excited to brew in this new format again. And I think it did that job very well, so mission accomplished. Would you also describe things like the Bloodbraid Elf and Jason Mindsculptor unbanned in those terms? Because at the time, there was a lot of doomsaying about those, and I think both of those worked out better than expected as well.
That's a good question. Maybe I just don't think about those cards as much. Bloodbraid, I wouldn't count. Like, I don't think Bloodbraid had any real impact. Jace is a bit more interesting and may just be a sign of the times with how much, just like the numbers on the card have, like, very specifically how 3 or 2 loyalty is just like completely vulnerable now. And I think that just like, numbers creep have kept that card out of the same vein, but yeah, it probably belongs in the same lump as Stoneforge.
Yeah, I think that they showed some foresight in recognizing that a lot of these cards, which were too good at some point, and you know, Bloodbraid Elf certainly was, although you could argue Bloodbraid was framed for the crimes of like Deathrite Shaman and a few other cards. Either way, I'm willing to give them some credit there. And then Jace was, you know, exiled from the outset, but it needed to be freed at some point, and so I think having the willingness to gamble on, yeah, we can do this and spice things up, and people will be grateful for this in the end, I think those two unbans coming when they did was almost a better call than the Stoneforge ban, which came in this context of upheaval where, okay, well, we'll just give them this too and see what shakes out, versus the like early 2018 Modern, which felt pretty stable and like pretty good for what it was. And this could have been this cat among the pigeons that upset everything, and instead it just made the format better and more diverse at the same time.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know how much of like Bloodbraid and Jace was like the format hasn't really changed a lot, but like maybe these shouldn't have been unbanned in the first place, versus Stoneforge being like an actual assessment of like, oh, Modern has changed enough that this is okay and this is the direction we want to move the format.
Yes. So having gone over some of the more respectable bans, let's talk about some of the more notorious bans that either came too late or just came out of the blue, or just left us scratching our head entirely.
Okay, let's start, because we stopped with Stoneforge Mystic. Let's start with Stoneforge Mystic and the dual decks exception, or the pre-con exception. This is like the worst. So when Stoneforge Mystic was banned in Standard, This is like a tidbit of lore that it's one of those things that I feel like everyone knows because someone has joked about it. But to reiterate, when they banned Stoneforge Mystic in Standard because it was beyond egregious, like it should have been banned. And then they printed Batterskull. Like the way ban announcements were timed in Standard at the time, like there was just one that happened, like New Phyrexia was released. And then there was like a couple weeks after until stuff got banned. So you just had the best deck in the format be the Callblade Stoneforge Mystic deck. And then they printed Batterskull and it just was better. Like it was beyond obscene and they banned it. The problem was, is that they had released a precon that had two Stoneforge Mystics as like a standard buy-in and didn't have like, it had, I want to say like Bone Horde as a living weapon thing to search up. Like it was a very bad deck, but they decided you were allowed to play that deck as it existed in Standard, and like could play the Stoneforge Mystics. I don't know. I think that that was just like beyond this realm of absurd of just like, I don't know, take the L. Let's go back. We also just talked about an unban. I would like to talk about when unbans go wrong, because there are two specific cards where they have been, that at least come to mind, there might be a third or fourth, where they have been banned and then unbanned and then rebanned. And then one of their cases, unbanned again and then rebanned again. And that is Golgari Gravetroll in Modern and Gush in Vintage, where it was unrestricted and then restricted. And like this whole back and forth, like, here's the deal. When you're talking about unbanning, like these cards that are good to unban, like Stoneforge Mystic is a card that costs mana and is a creature. Jace is a card that costs mana. Bloodbraid Elf is a card that costs mana. Gush and Golgari Gravetroll don't cost mana. Like, there is a category of cards which are just like, this is going to break something because it doesn't cost anything and you should just leave it be and not worry about it. And like, the Gush Dance was especially egregious because I am fairly sure that, like, when it was unrestricted in Vintage, there were stretches of time where it was probably the best thing to do, but, like, I think there was a reluctance in at least this was my take from playing with Gush in the, was it 2014 pre-Treasure Cruise era, where, like, okay, so I think that the decks that Gush was best in the era were Doomsday and, like, this Sultai Creatures deck. And I think the Vintage players were A, like, reluctant to play Sultai Creatures, and B, like, humans are just reluctant to put Doomsday into their deck because it's Doomsday. But, like, it probably should have been restricted then.
Yeah, so the exact timeline here for Gush is it gets restricted in Vintage in June 2003 when this Grotalk deck with Quirion Dryad and Psychotalk and the Fastborn Gush engine is taking over the format, and just Gush decks in general are at the top of the food chain, no clear predator there. That ban was inevitable. It was only a matter of time. And then it just kind of gets unrestricted out of the blue in June 2007, and then the next year it is re-restricted again because Grotalk, powered by Gush, is like, Is that and fully powered Flash going head to head at the top of the format, and Gush gets axed in this like this massacre of the good blue cards in Vintage, and then September 2010 rolls around, and you could probably go into the Wayback Machine and unearth the announcement from then and get to the exact reasoning, but for whatever reason it gets re-unrestricted at that time, and actually is pretty harmless for a while in there, although as you say, how much of that is just people aren't playing the good decks that have Gush in them, and like online Vintage didn't really exist for a lot of that time, so you just had paper Vintage, which is its own weird like semi-competitive, semi-casual ecosystem, and then it gets re-restricted in April 2017, so after almost 7 years again in the format, because once again things had just got to this point where you couldn't go on, and in particular the four Gush, four Monastery Mental decks just were it kind of impossible to beat and also impossible to watch as well. Like I remember just sitting out an entire VSL season, which used to be appointment viewing for me, because like I just can't do this anymore. this is so tough to sit through.
Yeah, when Gush is too good, it really, like, it's kind of funny that Gush survived the Treasure Cruise restriction to me, because those cards were paired hand in hand in the Delver decks that were really dominant in the era, and like, it's just the same thing. It's just the same thing where you just, like, reach a point of the game where you are drawing cards for literal free or actual positive mana in the case of Gush, where, like, you weren't going to make a land drop and then you just put a land into your hand and play it. Like, it is not a remotely fair card.
Yeah, and I almost wonder if they're going to make the mistake again and just unban Gush at some point in the future, which would once again be a terrible mistake, because not only has Mystic Sanctuary, among other things, been printed since then, but also, like, Doomsday is maybe the S tier deck in Vintage as it stands right now, and you don't want them to be able to play full Gush. You don't want other decks to be able to play full Gush either. It was just, like, maybe the first unrestriction in 2007, maybe you could understand how they got to that point. At the point where you're having to re-restrict a card, like, why are we making this mistake again? We knew exactly what was going to happen here.
Yeah, so anyways, never unban Golgari Gravefall in Modern. It's gone. Like, there are probably cards that are more gone than it, and I think we covered this in our discussion of bans, but, like, it is in that bottom tier of, like, it's never going anywhere.
Yeah, the Gush thing actually makes more sense to me in the context of Vintage, because A, it's Vintage, right? So in theory, anything goes, and if it's not Gush, something else is going to be obscenely broken, so whatever. If it's Gush, so be it. If it's Gush for the third time, then you probably made a mistake somewhere, but whatever. Also, Gush really fits into the mold of what people consider Vintage to be. Like, it's just an obscenely broken blue card, and that's where we get to play all of the obscenely broken blue cards, which are correctly banned in Legacy, and I guess not in Pauper, although eventually it very much was banned in Pauper too, so another data point there. But Golgari Gravetroll, to me, is, you could make a case that unbanning it at all was one of the more egregious unbans we've ever seen, because, like, did you get what you wanted? What were you hoping for when you released this card back into the format?
I think there was a very brief period where the Dredge deck was sort of cool, where there was, like, some Fate Stitcher nonsense. I forget the exact details, but, like, that deck was sort of interesting. It was not, like, if it was actually really good, it would have been not good to exist, but, like, it was cool because it wasn't good.
Yeah, there was a period where Raphael Levy was winning hearts and minds by, like, smallpoxing Life in the Loam into his graveyard at every modern proto or whatever, but that was the kind of small ball fair Dredge application that I think what they had in mind with mechanic, as opposed to the cast breakthrough Dredge 24 cards, Return of My Icarids application that very quickly took over in, like, 2006 2007, and, like, that is the natural endpoint of allowing people to play with Gravetroll, is they do that Dredge thing instead of, like, the cool, like, finicky Dredge thing.
Yeah, Dredge causes the exact same problem every time, and, like, I think we're just closer to every other Dredge card entering the banned or restricted list in its format than Gravetroll coming off.
Yeah, like, I don't know how close to that line Stinkweed Imp, I don't think it's close right now, maybe it has been close at some points in the past, but, like, yeah, summarily axe all of the Dredge cards from every format that they're legal in, maybe you could spare Life in the Loam or something, but I don't think people would be too sad about it.
Yeah, so let's, on the subject of unbans and bans, let's talk about the two classic pump fake bans where the cards should have been banned and then were promptly banned in, like, less than 15 days or whatever. So we have the time that Felidar Guardian was not banned because they said they fixed it with Manglehorn, and then that didn't work. And then there was the time that Omnath wasn't banned, and then Omnath was the best deck in the format, and then it was banned.
I would write in the Hogak fake out as another.
I forgot about there. That one in the middle too. That one was really bad too.
Understandable that you would want to memory hole that one entirely, but the Felidar Guardian ban, I don't know if in the abstract you should have different expectations for bans between different formats, but the fact that this happened in Standard, where you had this interaction that clearly was an oversight, I think they came out and said as much, that they just didn't catch us in time to make any changes that would fix it. That snuck into the format, and if there was sufficient counterplay, then maybe that would be one thing. We established pretty quickly that wasn't the case, and so there was this period of limbo where it seemed like the format had kind of adjusted, but not really, and it's like, well, okay, we can play with these cards, but it's going to be like a two or maybe three deck standard format. And then after holding off on the ban to the point where people, bought into the cards and started actually preparing for their tournaments with this in mind, they did the pump fake 2 days later and said, you know, just kidding, we are actually banning Felidar Guardian, which was the right move, but executed in such a way that, like, even the people who were on board with that move just had zero confidence in their ability to execute it at that point.
Yeah, that one's really special. They declared it wasn't an emergency ban because the ban list hadn't even come into effect, so they were just modifying the ban. Like, there was some hokey explanation about how it was not the first emergency ban since Memory Jar.
Yes, and so I remember in the context of the Amonkhet preview season, where everyone was, you know, making their podcasts and their articles and so on, trying to cover these new cards, but with this, like, looming subtext of, well, yeah, you can't really do this in a format where Saheeli Felidar Guardian is the obvious and only thing to be doing. So do we try and incorporate these cards into our Saheeli decks, or do we just take it as read that, of course, this is going to be banned before this becomes an issue? But that just overshadowed this entire, well, what should be this period of, like, fun and exploration where, okay, here are these cool new toys we get to play with, and instead there's just, like, this question looming over, which they then gave the worst possible answer to.
Yeah, and Omnath, I think, falls in, like, a very similar thing where, like, banning, like, sure, you banned Uro. Uro should have been banned before, but we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to talk about Omnath. That, like, 5 days of standard where Omnath and Uro were both legal is some of the worst Magic I have ever played. It is so unbelievably heinous because the two extremes of the game are a player doesn't play a land and then stops participating, or a player plays a land and then takes all the game actions and the other player stops participating. Like, it has real shades of some of the bannings from the 90s, and, like, I just don't understand how you got to the point with Omnath where you saw this happen, wanted to take action, and then said, but Omnath will be fine, right? Like, this card is not the... Just what? Just, no. Just, like, what were you doing?
I remember covering the online SCG Tour event in early ZNR Standard, but by the time you got to the winner's interview portion of those, part of me just wanted to berate the people who took part in the tournament. Like, you really had nothing better to do with your weekend? Like, this is what your life has led you to?
I think one of those was, like, a big end-of-season championship, which is the problem. It was, like, this huge event that everything was building up to, and it was just the worst. I think I remember playing in that tournament, and, like, I think I won multiple games by activating Kenrith targeting my opponent because that's just how things worked. Like, yeah, it was... not even, like, I had infinite mana. I just, like, had 12 mana, and they drew 6 cards, and all the other cards in their deck had been used.
It was a real shit show. I did like as well that there was one of these events. I think it was the grand finals, like the world that technically wasn't world, that the Austin Bursovich one, yeah. Where they had the standard portion and the historic portion, and by far the best deck and, like, the only playable deck in both formats was just the same deck. Like, if you crafted the standard deck and then you get to upgrade some of the lands or whatever, like, that's just your historic deck too. Like, it was just, and, like, it was weird watching, like, people register some people registered the deck in standard and then somehow tricked themselves into not doing that in historic, and the people who just did both in both just, like, cleaned up because duh, obviously.
Yeah, that was really bad Magic. That was, I think that was, like, the formal, like, that was the point where I think people, like, really just stopped caring about standard for, what was it, like, a solid 18 months?
Yeah, I think this was also the peak era of, like, commander design infecting standard, where when you look at, like, Omnath, but also, you know, Nissa Who Shakes the World, Fires of Invention, Wilderness Reclamation, there's all of these cards that just kind of cheat the fundamental mana system of Magic in a way that really is not sustainable in competitive 60 card formats, but maybe can do some cool things in Commander. Like, that is really the extreme of that era of design. And Omnath is, like, I've said on here multiple times, I kind of wish a lot of these Commander specific cards from those products would be legal in formats like, you know, Pioneer or specifically Modern, because they're designed in such a way that you do want to go out and build around them. To me, Omnath is like the opposite. It's a card which probably does do a lot of cool things in Commander, and I would want to build a Commander deck around that thing, but also is somehow legal in Standard with the obvious implications you'd expect from that.
Yeah, I think that there's a discussion to be had about this last batch of Standard bans, that they are also an offshoot of this exact problem in design, where if you look at the set, Neon Dynasty, the actual theme of the set is Moldrifters. Like, every card is a Moldrifter. Every playable card is a different form of, like, irreversible Moldrifter. And, like, I think that some of that has to do with this idea of building cards that are, like, not breaking the mana system, but maybe good in Commander because they do something else. And, like, breaking the card system is also, like, kind of egregious in the same way. And, like, I think that it's the, you know, it's the classic, like, Baneslayer. This is the problem we've talked about several times, where, like, if you make a Baneslayer Moldrifter, you have a problem. And it feels like that is a less egregious implementation of the same problem you're describing, where, like, one of the cool things in Commander is that you have one untap step for every other three untap steps. How do you break that? It's like, no, you don't want that. Like, just, like, let people play their spells on their turn with the mana they have. That's why Magic is a good game and why other games have problems.
Yeah, like, if Omnath just had ZNC instead of ZNR on the set symbol, fine. You know, great design, home run. Instead, they just completely fucked up Standard and also other formats for just no good reason. So that was pretty egregious. I would say the Felidar Guardian thing, like you mentioned losing confidence in Standard. You can time the decline of Standard over the years and pinpoint various causes and like when it started. I think that 6-month period of Kaladesh Standard, where, you know, we have that wave of bans of Smuggler's Copter, Reflector Mage, Emrakul, and then you get to the Saheeli Felidar Guardian fake out, ban but not ban, and then they just leave Marvel around and then end up having to ban Marvel anyway over the course of 6 to 8 months. That to me is when Standard kind of like jumped the shark officially, to the point where, yeah, I get why Standard FNMs aren't firing and people aren't buying in, because how could I make the case that you should when all of this shit is going on right now?
Well, yeah, let's rewind to that Marvel ban, because that was the next one on my list of, like, this is one of the worst bans of all time. Because I think that you are like, well, they didn't ban it with Felidar. Like, let's rewind. Like, Marvel should have been banned with Reflector Mage and Smuggler's Copter. Like, it was very clearly a problem all the way up front, and then it wasn't touched. Like, I cannot fathom how that happened.
Yeah, it's almost like the examples from that time period where, okay, we banned Field of the Dead, and now Oko is taking over. And then we ban Oko, and the next horrific thing is taking over. At least there, though, they were stacked on top of each other at first, and so it's maybe not completely obvious, although still pretty obvious, that once you ban the number one offender, the number two offender is going to take over. This was almost worse in a way, because Marvel had already been by far the best deck for a prolonged period of time, and it's only because for, you know, 2 to 3 months, you printed new cards that, like, pushed it out by being even more egregious. Of course, once you banned those, Marvel was going to come back because, like, duh. Like, we already saw this happen. It was just literally waiting just off stage left, ready to pounce again.
Yeah, that one was... Also, the fact that, like, Marvel was a worse play pattern than any of the cards they banned. Like, maybe you could argue that... that's okay, they banned Emrakul and Reflector Mage. Maybe Marvel is, like, on par with those cards in terms of how miserable it is.
I think also the fact that they put Marvel into a format with the Battle for Zendikar Eldrazi, where if the best thing Marvel was doing was, to use some more recent examples, just casting, like, an Atali or an Atraxa or something, that's still not a great play pattern, and it might honestly be too good still, but you could at least... That's, like, more normalized in the sense of, yeah, sometimes you do the energy thing and you cheat out your Atraxa, but then it dies and then you die. Or sometimes you don't do the energy thing, but you just cast your big thing and that's fine. The Eldrazi existing just pushed you to this point where either you did the Marvel thing and just cast Ulamog on 4 and there was no coming back from that, except by re-marveling into your own Ulamog. And there was this weird dynamic over, like, sometimes it was better to just not Marvel right away because you wanted to be the second one to Marvel. Or you just had this 10 drop in your hand that you weren't realistically casting, and there was not that much range of an outcome in between. But then also Marvel ended up being just like the best fair deck anyway, because you just had the Teemer Energy Core that was going to itself become banworthy less than a year later, just powering this like Rogue Refiner World of Virtuoso backup plan. It was really just I'm going to say a marvel to behold, but yeah, fill in the blank however you want there.
No, it was not a marvel. It was bad. I think that brings us... Well, okay, I got one more tolerable ban. And it's the fact that Agent of Treachery is just still banned. Like, that card, like, there's a concept of, like, banning the best thing and making sure it doesn't remain the best thing, but, like, that's the equivalent of, like, when you ban Marvel, you ban, like, what's, like, the third best Eldrazi to flip into?
I mean, there were only two, right? I guess, like, you could have played Coastlake or something if you wanted to.
Yeah, or, like, Worldbreaker or whatever. Like, that's the equivalent of it. Like, Agent of Treachery is just, like, still banned in a format, and that's, like, one of those, like, bar trivia questions. Like, well, name the cards from M20 that are banned in formats. It's like, oh gosh, what's the last one?
Oh, there are a lot of them. You have to go quite far down that list. But the funny thing about Agent of Treachery is it almost gave the game away because, yeah, we're banning it because the Fires Luka deck is, you know, the fourth insanely broken S-tier standard deck in the past 6 months. So we're banning this card from it, but also because we know that Winota is going to be that level of obnoxious before too long, and we're trying to, like, defang that by banning the best Winota target, but not actually banning Winota herself, but we're probably going to have to ban Winota herself eventually.
Yeah, it's just mistakes were made there, and we'll just move on from that there.
That does also, like, the storyline of Agent being banned in Historic does lead us into this arena-exclusive sublaw here of suspensions rather than bans.
Oh,
so this was
right.
A... too clever by halfway of trying to manage the ban list where a card would not be directly banned. You didn't have this binary of legal or banned. Sometimes they would be suspended. So they would be taken out of the format for some period of time, and then there would be a decision made down the line over, do we actually want to ban this, or do we think we could maybe release it once the context has changed? What that meant in practice was these cards just existed in limbo. As far as I know, people were not compensated for cards being suspended instead of banned, so you didn't get your wild cards back or anything. Please correct me if I'm wrong there. But
that's 100% how it worked.
Yep. And then also, because the main issue, well, one of the issues with the bans at this time was just communication, where it felt like whether the bans happened or didn't happen, there was no convincing rationale given and no timely rationale given. This just leaned into that problem even harder, where it's like, instead of having to actually explain what we're doing, well, we'll just suspend it, and then at some undefined point in the future, maybe something will happen to it. But we're not going to give the context for why, because we don't know ourselves yet. We just have this all-purpose tool for fixing that.
Yeah, and this is how we get stuff like Brainstorm. The Brainstorm Saga is another one of these egregious ones that I, like, basically don't count because it was a complete nonsense format, where Brainstorm was like, It's fine. We'll just get rid of, like, Time Warp or whatever. It's like, no, just... Why was this even there in the first place? Like, there were cards from that set that were just deemed too good, and this was not one of them.
Yeah, Lightning Bolt, that's over the line. We can't let that one into Historic. Brainstorm, that's okay. And maybe they wanted to have some kind of controlled experiment for this idea that, well, Brainstorm isn't good in a format without the actual Onslaught Fetchlands. Turns out, still pretty good. You know, Fable Passage is no Flutterstrand, but it's close enough to get over the line there.
Yeah, that one was quite bad. And I guess maybe, you know what? Another one that might belong on this list of discussions of, like, bans, I wonder how we're going to look back at the meet, like, in the context of we have banned Fable now as opposed to a year ago. I wonder how people will look back at the Meat Hook Massacre ban.
Yeah, I think it was Zach Keeney at the time who tweeted, what the hell, we all expected they were going to ban Fable, and a lot of their testing, or their preliminary testing, was, like, done with that in mind, and then they just didn't do that for some reason. Like, so yeah, I do think that at the time, like late 2021, Fable was not actually doing all that well. You know, the story of Standard was Esper, and then you had Mono Black, and, like, there were a few Rakdos shells going around, but when Nathan won Worlds with Grixis, Grixis was not an established deck. It was more like, this is what you do if you want to specifically hard target Esper, but it's not the best choice outside of that. It wrapped around to being the best choice anyway before too long, but there was a period where you could maybe make that argument, but I think even then you could tell that, like, I don't know if Fable is going to make it to the end of its natural lifespan here in Standard.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I don't think the format was made horrible by Fable existing, but it's a more mild form of these exact same things we've been complaining about.
circling back quickly to the brainstorm of it all and the mystical archive, so not only did they unleash brainstorm and time warp on that format, and I think history has shown that time warp effects that exile themselves or like don't put themselves in the graveyard at 7 mana are a problem, and time warp effects at 5 mana that you can recur and train together almost guaranteed to be a problem. So could have seen that one coming. They also let Tainted Pact be in the format via the Mystical Archive, which, like, that deck was one of the most broken decks for its format that I've ever seen, in a way that I found pretty compelling, just like the idea that this deck exists and the things you have to do to build this quasi-singleton deck, like, that is an interesting deck-building problem to solve. So for that one tournament, it was, like, a engaging problem to tackle. There was no way that could be allowed to last for any longer, though. Like, that, one of the coolest decks of all time, also one of the shortest shelf lives of any deck of all time.
Yeah, I think that Thassa's Oracle existing is something that you could talk about in the context of a lot of various bans or lack thereof, especially just like the longer the format goes on. I think it just, like, or just the game itself, like, it is just the best way to do that thing in such an efficient way that, like, I don't know, it's kind of like a Tendrils of Agony, but pushed even further.
Yeah, that's one of those seminal printings that if you just tweak one of the knobs on that even slightly, like if killing Thassa's Oracle in response to a trigger stood a chance of actually doing anything a lot of the time, maybe then the whole equation changes and it's a tolerable card to have in that role. As it is, it's just like the obvious go-to way to do anything once you've dealt with your entire deck, and that's actually a shockingly easy thing to do in a lot of these larger formats sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, we were just talking about the Ad Nauz players having to deal with Simeon Spirit Guides and Lightning Storms and holding priority, and like, you could just have a Thassa's Oracle.
Yes. So there are some other examples too. Like, we mentioned the Hogak ban that wasn't, which at the time, that one was as baffling as any of these other examples. Like, when they banned Bridge from Below, which already that was one of the more like polarizing angles of the deck, where you kind of had to have it just on raw power, but you almost wanted to be able to build the deck without it, and then they just let you do that anyway.
Yeah, that did not make a lot of sense.
Yeah, like, even if... So, they banned Hogak, and they banned Looting alongside it. I think understanding that, like, okay, Looting is another one of these cards which it's only a matter of time, and they were going to print Ox of Agonis in a few months anyway, so, like, Dredge was going to get rebroken again. Looting probably had to go, but the fact that they banned Hogak, like, there was an understanding that if they just banned Looting, that also would not have been enough. Just the card Hogak in some form or another would still have been the best thing to be doing. That, to me, felt foreseeable the moment the card Hogak appeared on the preview, let alone, you know, after an entire round of play with it and an entire ban cycle where you could have just axed that card the first time.
I really can't believe they let, you know, veteran Loxodon survive to win a Pro Tour. It's really just hard to believe.
We just make the same mistakes over and over again. History is doomed to repeat itself.
Yep. Anything else you want to include to wrap up this ban discussion here? Because I think those are the list of like good and bad we've had here. So there are some stuff in the funny realm that's worth discussing, I think.
Oh yeah, there's some fun like freestyle discussions we can have here. So in going over the history of these bans on the MTG fandom wiki page for it, which is a great resource to track this history, would recommend people look at that to just understand the timeline of all of this. There are some really choice quotes that jump out here. So here's one from the late 90s where they updated the ban list with a few cards from a few formats and also added, quote, "The head judge can't disallow any Magic expansion anymore," which is one of those things where you read it and immediately want to know the entire lore there on what exactly happened to usher that into the lore books.
You know, we could have a discussion about the modern day print quality of sets and how, like, if you play with Ice Age lands and current cards, that's an issue. But, like, we could just also pretend that the 90s were a time and a place and we don't have to live in them anymore.
This was also a time where judges in general had a lot more discretionary power, by my understanding. So there was this infamous incident at a French Nationals where there was some ruling with Yawgmoth's Will not being worded properly, so you could just effectively loop the same dark ritual in response to the trigger that would exile it from your own graveyard and just like make infinite mana, and then you can figure it out from there. And this was, by the letter of the law, legal for that tournament, and the judges said no, it's not. And so the people who showed up expecting to get to play with their broken deck that would exploit this loophole left having to scramble, and there was, in typical French fashion, a strike of sorts among the parts of the judge staff after the players themselves like rioted and treated the judge badly. Like it went exactly as you would expect that whole thing to go.
Yeah, anyways, this is why they reformatted a lot of the rules in the mid-2000s to make it so that the judge rulings were very standardized, and this maybe have been a early step in that right direction, or it may have just had to do with the card Sinbad. I really don't know.
Yes, speaking of weird rulings and things technically not working, let's talk about Time Vault here real quick. So this is a card which has an interesting ban history, which if you look at it without knowing the context, you're really wondering how this happened. So Time Vault, and I would recommend bringing up the Oracle text or whatever here on Scryfall or Gatherer if you are a Wizards employee, and just marinating in the current wording and then thinking about how this has changed over time. So it was restricted in the first ever BNR announcement back in January 94. Kind of made sense back at the time. It was banned in the March of that year. It was then unbanned in April of 96 and given this errata to function differently. So
okay, so I just want to pause right here and just discuss the fact that in the early 90s, Time Vault worked the way it did now. So people were casting Twiddle targeting it. So like that is what was happening in this 1994 era, was people were time walking with Twiddle and Time Vault.
And there was some more elaborate stuff with like Instill Energy once you'd animated your Time Vault or anything. But yeah, basically the current wording 30 years on of you tap it, you take an extra turn, which many would argue is the original and intended functionality of the card. That's how it worked. And you could build your decks accordingly. In April of 96, that changed. So in order to use that extra turn effect, you had to remove a time counter. And the way you got a time counter was, at that period of your untap step, you would get a choice to skip your turn, and that would put a time counter on your Time Vault. So there weren't really many ways around that, and so Time Vault kind of languished in obscurity for a while, until 1998, where they made a further attempt to kind of update the text of Time Vault so that it actually worked properly, depending on who you ask. And so this way, they added this condition where if you would start your turn, you could untap your Time Vault and skip that turn. But then that led to this weird question of, well, how do you skip the turn which you are currently in the process of taking, because you have to start your turn in order for that clause to like trigger or kick in the first place. And their solution to that was to have this between turns phase, if you like, where that decision could be made. It turns out that if you have a thing which is technically not part of a turn, then things which are limited to do this once a turn just don't have a restriction anymore. And so you could activate your Wall of Roots to just make infinite mana effectively. And so that this was used in conjunction, and this was at a time where the timing of when something would die, like, yeah, you're putting a counter on your Wall of Roots, but that's okay because it's not going to die because the timing of that is all messed up. So you could just make infinite mana with your Wall of Roots to put infinite counters on your Magma Mine. So you load it up with counters and then sacrifice it to deal damage equal to the number of counters on it. And so you had this three-card infinite combo that could win during just like this limbo period between any player's turn.
Yeah, this is one of those things you were talking about, like the judges saying this doesn't actually work. This is a great example of the judges just declaring that this was bullshit.
Yes, and so that led to its own backlash and attempt to restore the original functionality. So they went back to, I believe, the time counter setup after this brief debacle, until that errata was in turn removed in 2005, coinciding with the release of Ravnica, which also brought Flame Fusillade. So this was a card which gave every permanent the ability tap to deal one damage or something.
So, okay, I'm just like looking this up real fast. I'm pretty sure that the wording was kind of in there where it was, it turned into an activated ability to untap it and put a time counter on it by paying skip your next turn, which you technically have an infinite number of next turns, just like the game could take any number of turns. You could skip all of the rest of your next turns forever, which I think actually there may be like some stuff that people miss with like hard locks and like putting your opponent into decking with this. But again, Flame Fusillade rolls around, which is 3 and a red sorcery, give all your permanents, tap, ping a thing until end of turn. And if you just skip all the rest of your turns to untap your thing where you ping your opponent, you have paid now for a hamburger Tuesday. Is that how that phrase works? Or wait, no.
Something like that. But as you mentioned, there were other things you could do with that wording. So one of the early Time Bolt Flame Fusillade decks was just this red stack deck that paired it with Smoke Sack, where you could just skip a bunch of your turns and then your opponent would just have to sacrifice their own Time Bolt to Smoke Sack with no hope of ever getting out from underneath that lock and would just deck 25 turns from now. So a lot of stuff you could do with that, like reminiscent of a lot of the like stasis locks from back in the day as well. But yeah, this basically led to this legacy Grand Prix where if you wanted to play this deck, you had to obtain 4 copies of Time Vault, which at a time when, you know, revised your lands were $20 a pop and, you know, the cards had not ballooned to the prices that they are now, you could find 4 Time Vaults. That wasn't a prohibitive barrier to entry just yet. But then when Dissension released in 2006, they reverted to the time counter approach from before and then also from before the before, and so that combo didn't work anymore. And so if you bought a set of Time Bolts, you had bought a set of Lemons. Those didn't do anything for you. They went into a box and gathered dust. Hopefully not too much dust, though, because if you had kept those Time Bolts to the present day, they would be worth a pretty penny now.
Yeah, it was an interesting period there where, like, I think this sort of coincides with the Worlds where Legacy was part of the, like, day 3 of Worlds was Legacy, and like card, like, there was this weird problem of like the cards were harder to find than like the money was, like they just didn't exist but no one could buy them, and like it was kind of a foreshadowing of what was to come, it almost feels like.
Yeah, it was a very odd tournament to have Legacy in, because this was the old style Worlds where you would have the people who were on the pro train, but also the national teams from every country that was part of the system. So, you know, these 3 guys from Paraguay, well, they now had to find Legacy decks, right? And that was much, much easier said than done, even if you had the cash to splash around on that. So there was a lot of, yeah, I think it would be very difficult to track down the decks from that tournament. But from what I hear, you would see a lot of just like, okay, this is clearly informed by, this is a deck that I could find, as opposed to this is a deck that I wanted to play, which, bearing in mind, this is day 3 of the tournament with potential top 8, you know, Pro Tour top 8 implications on the line. That is a weird thing to have affecting the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly had other flavors of that, like the time everyone flew to Hawaii and left their Earls at home, but this was just another variant of that.
Yes. So in 2006, we go back to this original errata until like 3 months later we then have yet another attempt at changing Time Vault's functionality. So now it reads, if Time Vault would become untapped, you can skip your turn instead and put a counter on it and then tap and remove a counter to take that additional turn. And so this disabled the Time Vault combo, but opened up combos with, I think, Mizzium Transreliquat was one, and then Rings of Bright Hearth, which is the one that people played at that Worlds that you mentioned. So it just kind of like tipped along for a while longer until September 2008, once more, for the final time, all errata is removed. We go back to, or we go forward to, the functionality that it has now, where you just tap to take an extra turn. You can skip your turn to untap it, but if you have other ways to untap it, like Voltaic Key back in the day, or whatever it would be, that now translates into infinite turns. And so that change was made. The card was immediately restricted in Vintage, and then we just move forward with Time Vault in that role. And it's actually got a new lease on life in Vintage recently, because with Urza Saga, you have pretty consistent access to the 1 Manifold Key in your deck if you want to set that up. And so that package of 4 Saga, 1 Key, 1 Time Vault is the core of a lot of these kind of like big blue, Tinker Blue decks that you see in Vintage these days.
Yeah, and I think that you talking about this like Time Vault history actually ties into something that was happening earlier that year, which was when Flash was, you know, this restriction in Vintage and ban and like in Legacy and all this stuff. it was the same root cause of them, like, erasing all the errata and just trying to, like, make things work the way they did on the card, as opposed to, like, having cards that said they did a thing, but then, like, this, I mean, this is part of the reason why the companion rule change was so contentious at the time, where it was just like, we just don't do this on cards, and we haven't for 15 years, where the card now does something that is slightly different, but, like, on the card, it just tells you something that is a complete lie.
Yeah, I mean, there are, I think, some justified complaints about how a lot of Magic cards these days are, like, unnecessarily wordy in the sense that you clearly grok what the card is trying to do, but expressing that in Magic ease just takes so long, and that feels more acute at a time when the cards just have so many words anyways. But then you look at examples like this where they went through so many trials and tribulations just getting the card to do what they wanted it to do in a way that didn't blow up something elsewhere, that you get why, like, one of the advantages of Magic compared to a lot of other games is it mostly does have this, like, airtight rule system where you look at the equivalence of, like, the Wall of Roots between turns thing or whatever in other card games. Like, a lot of those are just recurring instances that happen over and over again, as opposed to, you know, some, like, funny story from the late 1990s.
Yeah, I mean, the Magic rules are they are very specifically designed in a way that is, like, this idea, like, I don't know, this also relates to the Hearthstone idea of where, like, you play a card and it just says a thing and it's kind of interpreted to, like, have a thing that happens. Whereas Magic is very much like, this is the rule book, you can read all 700 pages of it, but, like, it very clearly defines the state of the system and what is going to happen.
Yes. So any other Time Vault or non-Time Vault related comments before we wrap up this section as a whole?
No, I just want to complain about the fact that I can't put Lurrus in my main deck. Like, just, you know, we talked about the companion rule. Just, like, don't let us companion and just let us put Lurrus in our deck.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind casting Eladami's Call for Yorion once in a while. Just let me have my fun.
Yeah, like, I don't think that would be too bad. And people will play, you know, 70 cards anyways. Like, that seal's been broken.
It almost feels like they don't want to acknowledge companion as a mistake in a holistic sense, and so they're kind of over-punishing the companions which were the most offensive by also just, like, expunging their normal functionality as well.
Yeah, I think Lurrus would be a very interesting and powerful card to have in Modern, probably Pioneer 2.
Yeah, I think it would be cool, and this actually, like, this ties into some of the Vintage ban discussions too, because a lot was made of Lurrus being technically the only card to be banned in Vintage since, like, mid-1990s, because, well, what happens if you restrict Lurrus? They're just going to play the one on their sideboard anyway, so you actually have to ban it and take that radical step in a way that you don't have to do with literally any of these other cards in order to actually solve that problem there.
Yeah, that was certainly a weird corner case.
Yeah, but now Lurrus, they eventually unbanned Lurrus after a lot of prompting, and that has become, like, a pretty cool thing you can do in Vintage alongside all of the other, like, weird and wacky things you can do in that format.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly appreciate it, and it feels like it's actually fairly balanced, because the cards that see play that, like, you were talking about this, well, Lodestone Golem costs 2 in the format, but it doesn't actually cost 2, and there's a lot of that same stuff even in the blue decks. So yeah, Lurrus has a real cost.
So with that, we'll move on to our results and nonsense of the week, and with the results, we have the challenges from the last weekend to get to some big both Modern and Pioneer tournaments. We also want to maybe take a look forward to the results from this coming weekend, where I will be playing my RC, the people in the States will be playing theirs over in Dallas, Athens coming up this weekend as well. So a lot of stuff to think about where Pioneer is concerned, and we don't want to be waiting for those results. We want to be shaping those results insofar as we can.
Yeah, I think that you want to start with Pioneer? So we had the LMS last weekend, the Legacy Magic Series. Is that what those? I've just lost track of the acronyms over the last few years. The MPL broke me.
I want to say Legacy Masters Series, which feeds into the Legacy European Championship, maybe?
Okay. Anyways, there was a large 400-person, 387, I think, player Pioneer event across the ocean in Europe. And despite all these shoutings that the sky is falling and that Hogak was here, Rakdos and Mono Green did very good, and the Boros deck did just fine.
Which is that reassuring or is that demoralizing?
I think reassuring. I think there's still a little more room to see exactly how good the Boros deck is with another weekend of people able to literally find the cards, but it is promising when a new deck is exciting and just becomes part of the metagame. A deck that did not do well was Azorius Control, which put up one of the single worst tournament results of all time, almost. It was like the third most played deck in the field, and one copy made day two.
I kind of now want to read or listen to some kind of interview with that one Valiant person who managed to slog through that uphill battle.
Yeah, I mean, I think Azorius Control is better than the hate it is currently getting. However, I think that the core problem of you don't beat Rakdos and you have to play against Rakdos, that's just not going to fly.
Yes. So I don't know. It feels like whenever I come in here and I say, well, hey, Blue Eye Control had a great weekend. I wonder why people aren't playing it. Maybe I should be one of the people playing it. I always end up getting burned by the results of the very next Pioneer tournament.
Yeah. I mean, the answer is that it doesn't win, apparently. My suggestion, like, I would play Rakdos. That has not changed. I think Siggy brought up an interesting point, which is that the mono green deck consistently performs, or it feels like to him, at least, I haven't checked the math, that the mono green deck performs better at closed decklist events, because he was just, like, talking about this phenomenon where, like, you keep a hand and you played your Spikefield Hazard on turn one and they played Llanowar Elf and you're like, what the hell?
Yes.
And that deck is, like, significantly more polarizing because, like, that is basically the, like, only decision point of the game.
Yeah, Spikefield Hazard is an interesting example there because it either murks their elf on turn one and maybe they just their deck doesn't function for the rest of the game, or you have the buyout of it just being your second or third land drop, right? Whereas a card like Fatal Push, which is normally what your elves are hoping to dodge, it kind of either is doing the thing or it isn't. And so in an open decklist setting, you know, how do both players' mulligan decisions get informed by the fact that they know what the matchup is? Like, you kind of know if you're the Fatal Push deck, if you want to be keeping a hand with the Fatal Pushes, where if it's, you know, if you're against, like, the one copy of Blue Eye Control, or you're against Lotus or something, obviously that's not great. Whereas on the green side, like, especially against the kind of decks which are most likely to kill your elves, there's a broad subset of hands which are maybe not keepable in the dark because they're just too slow, and especially if you're against the mirror or something, like, you're just going to get run over. Whereas if you know that your turn one elf is likely to die, you're going to be prizing the hands which just go, like, turn two Haven into turn three Cura a lot more highly than a hand which, like, if your elf dies, you don't know if you're ever going to do anything again.
Yeah, you know, very typical mono-green scenarios of, like, these are your cards, you are going to cast them, and you are going to hope that the game does not implode on you.
Yeah, so you can make a convincing argument, I think, that open deck lists helps mono green and also helps the people playing against mono green, which is what you'd expect in the abstract, right? And you expect that to kind of wash out. I don't know if it actually does in practice, and we haven't had enough, like, large Pioneer tournaments with open deck lists to really make that determination one way or the other, I think. Because, like, you could go back to the last RC season and look at how green performed there, but the format just also looked pretty different at that point too, so I don't know how useful that data would even be.
Yeah, the format definitely feels like it has significantly evolved, and we're just going to see the next step of that evolution this weekend.
But yeah, it was. So you said you would play Rakdos. Jarvis has come in here and spoken about Rakdos a lot. I sleeved up my copy of Stock Green last night and might just submit that as my default. And so if you're in either of those camps, I think these are quite heartening results. The actual best performer on the weekend was Karuga Fires. Small sample size, but it seemed like that deck did pretty well. And that's a deck which looks very strange on the surface. And this is the incarnation list of Karuga Fires, not the kind of Karuga Fires deck circa the last RC season with a bunch of, like, Omnaths and Skyclave Apparitions and so on. And this deck looks... it looks very strange. Like, I saw someone comment that, like, imagine flying 5 hours to Texas, paying your hundreds of dollars and taking your time of work or so on, and then you sit down for round one and you open your hand and it's like Atraxa, Enigmatic Incarnation, 2 lands that don't cast your spells, no spells you can cast before turn 3, and, like, you know, your Karuga off here on the side, and it's like, yeah, this is the experience that you signed up for here. But the people who did sign up for that experience actually did pretty well. So I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how different that experience is than the mono green experience you're sleeving up. So I'll just throw that out there.
Yes, that is a fair counterpoint. And I guess the story from this weekend is the story from last weekend, which is Blue Eye Control cleaning up over here, and then this totally opposite deck in Convoke cleaning up over here. You don't really have to account for either of those threats anymore, and so you're kind of back to whatever your plan was before. So whether that's targeting Rakdos and green, or whether it's just playing Rakdos and green, I think either of those is a fine approach. But you know, if you had a deck which you were excited about, but you think the Convoke matchup is pretty dicey, well, you can probably just still play that deck this weekend and be comfortable with it.
Not a lot has happened, but like the fact that not a lot has happened is sort of helps move decisions forward.
Yes. A quick check-in with Modern, and I know that we tend to do these quick check-ins these days. I think when we have a slow news week, we will do a more prolonged results segment once again, but luckily, and it's a good problem to have, we just have a lot to talk about. So I think one of the big stories from the Modern challenges recently is kind of a bit of a return to how things were a few months ago, where like a little bit more Murktide, a little bit more Scam, Hammer. It went through one of those periods where it just like disappears like a submarine, but now it's kind of back, sort of. And then Breach actually putting up a result after a few months, which, you know, it was always on Manguchi's tier list, just hovering around the B tier, you know, despite not actually doing anything. Now it's done something, so God only knows what tier it'll be in next month.
Yeah, I was very amused by, like, this happening basically a week after people were making fun of Breach for doing nothing. So, great timing, good comedic timing. The one deck I do kind of want to point out that's been winning a lot lately that might not make a lot of sense to people is Tron. That was kind of what I dipped my toes into this week, and my sort of understanding of playing it is that it feels like the kind of thing where it is very ingrained in everyone's memory of recent, like, a lot of recent format play where, like, you just play against the Roggevon decks with Tron and then you die because your opponent just goes Roggevon on one, disruption spell, you're dead. Like, the game just ends before you do anything and everything falls apart. And if they have any semblance of interaction, it's horrific. That just hasn't been where the format has been for the last few weeks. Basically, like, the amount of dropped to really low levels. The amount of Rakdos is basically non-existent. So you're competing against, like, okay, so Creativity is a fine matchup. Like, you can actually beat a Resolved Archon with your deck. The Hammer matchup is, sure, that's a problem, whatever. We can talk about other stuff going on there, but, like, I don't know, like, Mill was a big deck for a while, and you just can put a Cause of Luck in your main deck, and no one cares. Another thing is that, like, a lot of the interaction that should beat Tron moved to things along the lines of, like, a Dovin's Veto. And these decks have just, like, started playing a bunch of creatures and putting them on the stacks. Or Force of Negation is probably the more accurate example. Like, you would lose when all your cards were Karns and Ugins, and you just get Force of Negation twice. When you just cast a Sundering Titan, your opponent's like, well, that's all my stuff. It's gone. I think that Tron was a reasonable choice for a non-Roggevon metagame, and that was kind of the missing piece in, like, where that deck came from.
Yeah, Tron, after all these years, still the best thing if people are just really trying to go big, and you're not getting bonked by Hammer early as much anymore, and the Roggevon decks were receding for a bit. So if you have time to get to turn three and count to seven, it's still pretty good to count to seven.
Yeah, and some of this also has to do with, like, so I do not believe, so the thing that the Tron deck was, so, like, there's this sort of phases of Tron. Let's just sort of rewind. There's the, like, pre-London Mulligan Tron. I don't want to get too deep into it. There's the London Mulligan Tron deck that was, like, mulliganing to four just because, like, it would make the mana and then it would cast the thing, and that was hopefully enough. And then we have the post-Modern Horizons 2 Tron deck where the Mull to 4 plan actually just loses because people have the interaction needed to beat a Karn Liberated. Like, you just kill their land and then they cast Unholy Heat and that's it. So what's really actually happening is that Tron is back to being playable again when you can keep these hands that are, like, you get a free mulligan, you maybe get two free mulligans, but, like, the hand does that look close enough on 6 or 5 are actually, like, if those are good to keep, then that's a good time to play Tron. That's sort of my general assessment of it.
Yeah, if you have to assemble Tron on turn 3 every game, but there's also no guarantee that's even fast enough, like, if you're on the draw or no guarantee it beats what they're doing, that's a really rough space to be in. And Tron is capped at how quickly it can do things or how well it can do them. If you have more time to just take your time, assemble Tron, and then figure it out from there, well, then that's still a great place to be in. Like, Tron has enough consistency, even though it's easier for people to interact with, like, your Turn 1 Expedition map or your Turn 2 Sylvan Scrying. Like, regardless of that, like, if you give Tron the time to breathe, it will take advantage of that, and that's kind of the story that we saw over the past few weeks.
Yep. I think with that discussion of the actual results, it is time to turn to, I think, something that is less, you know, we've had a lot of nonsense that are also results. This one is moving back towards the true nonsense, but it still sort of is a result. So, this last week, a Kethys deck kind of popped up out of nowhere in Modern. But, like, it is a double graveyard combo Kethys deck?
Yeah, so Kethys in Modern has always been one of those things which I expected to feature in a nonsense segment at some point, but it kind of took a while for that to manifest. It also very briefly existed. I remember Collins Mullen playing it at some ACG Open, but this was in the heyday of, I think, Throne of Eldraine had just come out, and there was a lot of hype around, like, PO and Jeskai Ascendancy with Emery and all of this other nonsense, and so this kind of got lost in the shuffle. But just that idea of Grinding Station with Kethys, and Mox Opal then, Mox Amber now, that was a precursor to, like, the Grinding Breach deck, which has really cemented itself in Modern over the past year, and it's easy to write it off now as a worse version of that deck, but this does actually still have some stuff going for it.
Yeah, so this specific deck is a, it's pairing the Kethys Grinding Station combo with the Rona, like, Retraction Helix combo. So you have Rona in your Kethys deck as, like, a very reasonable legend. There's a very small splash of Retraction Helix, but it is there as a backup combo. And the sort of endgame is that you are, like, looping Jace the Perfected Mind as the kill condition.
Yeah, this was an upgrade that we saw at one of the historic events where, like, Kethys is actually a force to be reckoned with. I think maybe the last Arena Championships. So Jace the Perfected Mind, it is a really nice setup card for your Kethys, but it's also the ideal win condition once you've looped through your deck and you just want to find a way to actually win. Well, this is a card which you just recast and then -2 mill 15 over and over and win the game that way, in a way that's also compatible with your companion Gigantha and so on. Like, it's just a nice way to economize all of that.
Yeah, Phyrexian blue mana and blue mana are not the same mana symbol.
Shockingly, yeah. So it's always fun looking at these Kethys lists to see what weird mix of random legends they accommodate. So you got some of these random legendary lands. We have an Oath of Nyssa, which, if you're doing the sub combo with your one Retraction Helix in your Rona, you can pick up and recast the Oath of Nyssa, and that's a legend, so it untaps your Rona over and over again. And then in the sideboard, we have the following legends. One Gemstone Caverns, which it's easy to forget that it's a legend to your detriment sometimes. Two Lavinias, a Filigree Silex, so a Ratchet Bomb, which now happens to be legendary for your Kethys, a Stone Drain, a Loran of the Third Path, an Orvar the Ore Form, which you kind of forget about every aspect of that card other than I discard it to copy an Archon, but it is also a legend. A Sky Sovereign, a Scarab Guard, which I'm not quite sure what that one is doing there, and a Psymaster Thopterus, which is also, once you have the Grinding Station Kethys thing going, once you're making an extra artifact and therefore an extra station activation with every loop, well, that's an easy way to just fully go infinite.
Yeah, I am very amused by all of this. I think the most amusing part to me is actually the mana base, which includes the following, two Glimmer Void, four Plaza of Heroes, four Urza Saga, just quite the tag team.
Yes, I tried sketching a Kethys deck at some point that had Ragavan, Emery, and Kethys, and also Urza Saga, just every color of the rainbow, and it turns out that might be stretching it a little bit too far. This one also quite ambitious, but we have some Chromatic Stars to kind of tie the room together here.
Yeah, I'm sure that will fix everything.
Yes, but Plaza of Heroes is actually a really massive pickup for this deck. And also, Rona, both by itself and then also with Kethys. So if you have Kethys and Rona, and I think it's maybe any 2-1 mana legend. So because of Kethys cost reduction, Hope of Ghirapur costs 0, and so it it loops into this as well. I think any two legends means you like cycle through them and then you're untapping Rona each time, and then as long as you're discarding legends, you can like keep surfing the wave, as Greg Catch put it, and just keep cycling through your deck. And at some point, once you find the right cards, that does translate into just actually going fully infinite. So that's another way to go off without needing like the Grinding Station or some of the other setup pieces. And then also Rona by itself in a deck with just eyeballing this like 20 something legends, well, that just tears through your deck so fast that you will find the missing pieces at some point.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, I forgot about the first line of text on Kethis.
Easy to do. Yeah, it doesn't actually come up all that often, but it's a good one.
Yeah, that is a pretty cute little way to set up additional zeros for your Grinding Station setup.
Yeah, Hope of Giripo stands out as well, as like it is a one-cost legend that becomes a free legend, but also if you get to connect with it and then sacrifice it, well, you now have this level of security that your Kethis is going to survive. Doesn't shut off stuff like Solitude and stuff because it's only non-creature spells, but it gives you some decent coverage at least.
Yeah, just draw the one Skrell, it's fine.
Yeah, also Teferi Time Raveler for all of your like Grand Abolisher needs. So I don't know if Kethis is good, but I like that it's showing up. And this list, I think it 5-0'd, and then Nassif picked it up and got a 5-0, like an actual 5-0, not a Nassif 5-0, with it himself. So maybe this one has some legs.
I'm sorry, your description of an AC5-0 kind of broke me for a minute.
Well, on that happy note then, I think we can get out of here for the week. So if you want to find us, you can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier, at ARMLX. You can find our content over at SEG and CFB/TCG Player, respectively. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Dominario_pod, or over on Patreon, as our new patron John did, over at patreon.com/dominariusjudgment. And then you can find us and John and many other people discussing God knows what. I'm sure Lee and others are in there discussing Kethis right now over in the Discord. So the link to all of that will be in the show notes. We'll be back next week with the Lord of the Rings previews, which we intended to start in here, but we spent so long reminiscing about Time Vault that something had to give. But rest assured, we will be going over all of that and much more when you come back for another very normal episode here next week. Take care, everyone.